Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. In this edition, we have wrap-up reports from the Olympic track and field trials in Eugene last weekend. Northwest athletes dominated the field. We'll meet one Olympian who qualified for his fifth games at the age of 41. In the second half, we'll go with a community organizer from Washington State who wanted to see for herself what police life was like. Austin Jenkins has the story. This is The Bridge for the week of July 14th. Northwest athletes were well represented the final day of the U.S. Olympic track and field team trials in Eugene last weekend. The same can be said of the U.S. track and field team as a whole, as correspondent Tom Bonsi explains.
Time and again, the capacity crowds at historic Hayward Field had reason to go nuts for a local athlete. Six more qualified on the final day of action on the track Sunday. The strong representation of athletes with Northwest connections, especially to Oregon, is not a surprise to the head coach of the U.S. Olympic women's track and field team. Connie Price-Smith comes from Ole Miss, by the way.
You know, it is Tracktown USA. They have a great college reputation, and you have a lot of athletes, post-collegiate athletes, that are here training.
Sports apparel giant Nike sponsors several professional training groups at its headquarters campus in Beaverton and another one in Eugene. All of them placed runners on this year's Olympic team. Seattle-based Brooks Beast Track Club produced one Olympian, too. I'm Tom Bonsi in Eugene.
On the track Saturday night was a 41-year-old distance runner nicknamed the Ageless Wonder. Former Washington State University track star Bernard Lagat finished first in a furious sprint to the finish of the 500 meters and qualified for the Olympics for a fifth time.
I train with young guys, and I don't believe like, you know, I'm old, because if you believe you're old, I'm going to run like an old man.
25 athletes, or close to one quarter of the track and field team headed to Brazil next month, have ties to Oregon or Washington. We wish you all good luck. Oregon voters may get the chance to ban the sale of items made from certain wildlife species this November. Backers of an initiative that would do just that submitted signatures in an attempt to get their measure on the November ballot. Salem correspondent Chris Lehman has more. 25 athletes, or close to one quarter of the track and field team headed to Brazil next month, have ties to Oregon or Washington. And Oregon voters may get a chance to ban the sale of items made from certain wildlife species this November. Backers of an initiative that would do just that submitted signatures in an attempt to get the measure on the November ballot. Salem correspondent Chris Lehman reports.
How much impact could a ban on sales in Oregon have on the global ivory trade? Former Republican State Senator Bruce Starr says it's a start.
I mean, when you look at the whole world, you know, Oregon's, you know, one kind of speck on the planet. But the reality is that we can do our part. And Oregonians, I think, will want to do their part.
And in fact, it would be more than a start, since Washington voters approved a similar measure last year, and California lawmakers approved a ban with a vote in the legislature. The initiative would fine people caught selling any part of a dozen types of animals. There would be exceptions for certain antiques, such as firearms and musical instruments. The measure is opposed by the National Rifle Association, which says it would punish honest people by making their lawful property worthless. I'm Chris Lehman in Salem.
The Oregon measure is being bankrolled in part by the Humane Society of the United States. The effort is also being supported financially by Seattle-area billionaire Paul Allen, who poured money into last year's Initiative 1401 in Washington. That passed overwhelmingly with 70% in support. The Oregon legislature considered, but ultimately rejected, a bill last year that had a similar effect as Initiative Petition 68. The measure was sidetracked by opposition from gun and knife collectors. The Oregon measure is being bankrolled in part by the Humane Society of the United States. The effort is also being supported financially by Seattle-area billionaire Paul Allen, who poured money into last year's Initiative 1401 in Washington. That initiative passed overwhelmingly with 70% support. The Oregon legislature considered, but ultimately rejected, a bill last year that would have had a similar effect as Initiative Petition 68. The measure was sidetracked by opposition from gun and knife collectors. Washington state ballots will not include a measure that had been opposed by gay and transgender rights activists. Backers of a ballot initiative to restrict which restrooms transgender people can use failed to turn in sufficient number of signatures. Even with that initiative falling by the wayside, a bumper crop is headed for the November ballot. John Ryan has more.
You may have been approached for your John Hancock more than usual in recent months.
Hi, ladies. How are you?
Would you like to help us get Initiative 1464 on the ballot?
Signature gatherers have been pounding the pavement. Some of them are volunteers who believe in a cause, but mostly they're workers paid to sign you up, as much as $6 a signature.
Gentlemen, how are you? Would you like to help us put Initiative on the ballot to clean up politics in Washington State?
This year's Initiative campaigns have paid their panhandlers of penmanship more than $1.5 million, and that's before the final signature push of the past month. One of two measures aiming to limit money in politics has already earned a spot on the November ballot. So has a carbon tax. Other initiatives are scheduled to turn in their signatures by the deadline. Those measures aim to raise the minimum wage to $13.50, restrict access to guns, and increase penalties for fraud against seniors. Election officials still need to certify that each campaign has at least a 250,000 ballot signatures. If they do, this year's ballot would tie the record for the most initiatives in the past 100 years. Only once, back in 1914, did the state have more initiatives on the ballot, with 7. Mark Smith is a political scientist at the University of Washington. He says in the early years of the 20th century, many people in Washington felt
that the political system was controlled by elites, that special interests had taken over, they had too much power in the legislature.
Sound familiar?
And the idea was, let's figure out a way to bypass the legislature, to involve the people in some means other than just voting on candidates. So how about if we have them vote directly on proposed laws?
Smith says today, with paid signature gatherers, it doesn't take a good or popular idea to get on the ballot so much as money.
A certain number of people will sign an initiative petition almost regardless of the content. You know, certain people, if they're going to the grocery store or the mall or whatever, they just don't want to be bothered. And it becomes just a numbers game. If you ask enough people, you will get your way on the ballot.
Jenny Bowser studies ballot measures. She's a political consultant in Portland. She says special interests have found a way to take over what was intended as a populist reform.
You see corporations and interest groups sponsoring initiatives that will enrich them. That, I think, is contrary to the very spirit that the initiative arose from. The initiative started in the West, and the initiative was meant to be a way for citizens to go around the legislature when the legislature wouldn't act because they were in the grip of the railroads and other industries.
5 of this year's 6 initiatives have already raised more than $1 million each. Altogether, backers have poured about $10 million into this year's initiative campaigns. Most of that money has come from a few billionaires, labor unions, and out-of-state interests. Bowser calls initiatives the Wild West of money in politics.
Money in initiative campaigns is almost entirely unregulated. There are no limits in any state on how much you can contribute to an initiative, and there are no limits on how much an initiative campaign can spend.
The one time Washington State had more initiatives on the ballot? Well, the voters of 1914 rejected most of the measures, but they did agree to prohibit the sale of intoxicating liquors. Prohibition became the law of the land for nearly 2 decades. In Seattle, I'm John Ryan.
One in 7 households in Oregon struggled to afford food last year, according to a new survey conducted by Gallup. Although more than 14% of families still struggle with hunger at some point last year, the rate has been steadily decreasing since the Great Recession. In 2010, 1 in 5 families struggled to put food on the table or faced food hardship. Matt Newell-Ching of Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon says SNAP benefits, or food stamps, could be the reason more Oregonians are putting meals on the table.
Since 2014, Oregon's been doing a little bit better than the rest of the country
One of the reasons we think that's the case is because Oregon has a relatively high participation rate in nutrition programs like SNAP.
Oregon's rate of food insecurity is below the national average of 16%. The state's hunger rate is higher in rural areas than in urban areas. Single mothers have been especially hard hit since the economic turndown. Oregon State University research says that about one half of single mother households struggled in 2014 to provide food for their families. Newell Ching says the high cost of childcare is a major problem for single working mothers.
Think about a mom who has worked all day, put in shifts at one, maybe two jobs, coming home, putting their kids to bed, making sure that her kids are well fed, and in so doing, skipping a meal. I mean, that's really the face of hunger that we're talking about in Oregon.
Newell Ching adds that along with single mothers, many of the people who are experiencing hunger are people with disabilities who are unable to work and seniors on fixed incomes.
Out of his secret garden somewhere in New Jersey comes your newest favorite superhero.
It is I, Captain Vegetable, with my carrot and my celery. Eating crunchy vegetables is good for me, and they're good for you, so eat them too, for teeth so strong your whole life long. Eat celery and carrots by the bunch. Three cheers for me, Captain Vegetable. Crunch, crunch, crunch.
Ah, yes, eat your vegetables. It's a refrain parents tell their children all the time. Government guidelines recommend kids eat 3 to 5 servings of vegetables a day, as much as a cup of veggies with every meal. Are Oregon children eating any vegetables? Jennifer Margulies went on a mission to find out.
7th and 8th graders at Ashland Middle School are tearing down the hall to the cafeteria. The morning's learning has made them hungry. As anyone with older children and teens can tell you from the sticker shock of grocery bills, kids this age eat a lot, between 2,200 and 2,800 calories a day. These Ashland middle schoolers jostle each other in line, pile their trays with food, and throw themselves into their seats. I ask 13-year-old Joshua Canetti Wilson what he's having for lunch.
I am currently enjoying 2 slices of pizza.
What kind of pizza is it?
It's pepperoni pizza.
And what are you drinking?
Lemonade.
Joshua's a 7th grader at Ashland Middle School with curly brown hair, brown glasses, and a wide smile. He tells me he ate pancakes for breakfast. Joshua says he likes vegetables, especially broccoli and Brussels sprouts. But he has not eaten a single vegetable today.
A lot of kids, they don't really eat a whole lot of vegetables, and their parents don't really enforce it very much.
In order for kids to get all the nutrients they need, the Federal Office of Disease Prevention and Health Promotion recommends that children ages 2 to 6 eat 2 servings of vegetables a day. Older children and teens need 4 to 5 servings. A serving of vegetables is more than you might think. 1 cup of raw leafy greens, 1/2 cup of other kinds of cooked or raw vegetables, or 3/4 cup of vegetable juice.
So, over here at Cell Bar, there's 6 different trays that have a variety of things. We try and keep it about half vegetables and half fruits.
That's Jeff Miles. He's the cafeteria manager at the Ashland Middle School.
Kids should be eating vegetables with every meal, regardless if it's breakfast or lunch or dinner. Fruits and vegetables should account for about 50% of your meal.
He's been working in food service management for over 25 years.
It's a well-known fact that over 90% of the kids in the United States don't get enough fruits and vegetables in their diets, and so that's what we advocate.
My fact-finding mission is far from scientific, but I talked to over a dozen 6th, 7th, and 8th graders, and not a single one has eaten a single vegetable today. One 6th grader has a noodle dish that contains scallions. The only student who even comes close is 12-year-old Amelie Kirkland.
Here's some Capri Sun, berry flavored. I have some Lay's chips, and I have a sandwich. I have some gummies and jerky. I never really have vegetables, but I usually always have a fruit.
In Amelie's ham and cheese sandwich is a single piece of lettuce. The only problem is that Amelie says she's not planning to eat it. Amelie admits she doesn't ever eat vegetables for breakfast or for lunch, but she does think eating them is important.
You should have vegetables because if you just have junk food or things like that, you'll never be healthy and strong.
Indeed, all the kids I interview say they like some vegetables and they think they probably should be eating more. So the message that vegetables are an important part of a healthy diet does seem to be getting across. But that doesn't mean Oregon children are actually eating any. I asked Maria Malott, a Los Angeles-based parent, coach, and educator, what parents can do.
Your job is to decide which foods are healthy for your child and put them on the table frequently. And your child's job is really to decide whether they're going to eat them or not.
Malott says it helps to have a garden at home or at school so children can see how vegetables are grown and taste them fresh from the soil. It's also really important, Malott says, to model good eating habits. But you can't fake it.
It doesn't help to try and force some vegetables down your gullet just so that you can show your child that you're eating them. If you're modeling, you really need to be modeling that you're enjoying it.
Want your kids to eat vegetables? Serve them up for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Offer vegetables to snack on throughout the day. And eat lots of vegetables yourself with every meal. Not because you have to, but because you love them. Jennifer Margulis reporting.
You're listening to The Bridge. The Coos Bay Rail Line will receive $11 million in federal funds. The Department of Transportation is awarding a grant to fix tunnels along the tracks linking Eugene and Coquille. Democratic Congressman Peter DeFazio spoke about the project with correspondent Kyra Buckley.
Less than a decade ago, the rail was in miserable condition. That's according to Representative Peter DeFazio. He says in 2009, the Port of Coos Bay bought the rail from a private company that wanted to shut it down.
We got some federal grants. State chipped in some money. We saved the line. It's growing. And, you know, what it needs is more investment because it still is suffering from the years of decay when the Wall Street vultures owned it.
DeFazio is the senior Democrat on the Transportation Committee. He says he requested the $11 million grant in order to rehabilitate the crumbling tunnels.
I've been out on this line, and they had me in the back of one of those trucks that you can run on the rails, and I was sitting there outside uncovered, and I had to put my hood up because the water was just pouring through these tunnels.
There are 9 tunnels, all of which are over 100 years old, on this portion of the Coos Bay Rail Line. I'm Kyra Buckley reporting.
Passenger trains are one of the more environmentally friendly ways of moving people between cities. With that in mind, Oregon and Washington have invested nearly $1 billion in operating and improving the Amtrak Cascades Rail Line since it was launched in 1993. The line runs between Eugene, Oregon and Vancouver, Canada. Now a federal agency is floating proposals that opponents say could make the Northwest's main passenger rail line run slower, later, and less reliably. Correspondent Leah Moriarty has more.
Since Amtrak was formed in 1971, the railroad companies that own the track on which most Amtrak trains run have been required by law to give preference to passenger trains over the railroad's own freight traffic. But now the Surface Transportation Board in Washington, D.C. says that doesn't necessarily mean Amtrak trains always get to go before freight trains. That interpretation doesn't cut any ice with Representative Peter DeFazio.
Congress was quite clear that we wanted preference for Amtrak to help improve their performance over freight.
The Democrat from Oregon's 4th District was among the lawmakers who wrote a bill in 2008 intended to deal with Amtrak's widespread on-time performance problems. DeFazio says allowing Amtrak trains to go before freight trains was exactly what Congress intended.
We were not saying, oh, yeah, maybe every once in a while a slow freight will use the siding for Amtrak, but you know, most of the time they'll just keep doing what they're doing.
The other proposal by the Surface Transportation Board would measure on-time performance at the beginning and end of a rail line. For the Amtrak Cascades, that means most stops, including major cities such as Seattle and Portland, could be considered intermediate stops and wouldn't be factored in. Likewise with the Amtrak Coast Starlight line that runs between Seattle and Los Angeles. Bob Melbo, state rail planner for the Oregon Department of Transportation, says that approach could understate the number of late trains.
The on-time performance at all the stations on a train's route, whether they be the endpoint or the intermediate points, should be accorded equal weight. Because if your destination is at one of the intermediate points, the performance of the train at that point is what's important to you.
On the Cascades route, close to half of all passengers get off at intermediate stations. Elected officials from across the country have weighed in on the STB proposals. Nearly all oppose them, saying anything that makes it easier for railroads to give their freight operations a boost at the expense of Amtrak trains could cause passenger service to suffer. ODOT's Bob Melbo says Governor Kate Brown sent a letter expressing her concerns about the proposals.
She said passenger trains should run reliably on time. Host railroads must give passenger trains preference over freight. And the host carriers have a responsibility to provide facilities and operating practices to minimize delays to passenger trains.
The mayors of Portland, Eugene, Albany, and Salem wrote to express their disapproval as well. Groups that support passenger rail have also raised concerns that more delays could sour the public on intercity trains.
Reliability is critical to ridership.
Bruce Agnew is with the Cascadia Academy, a transportation policy and research center in Seattle.
And if there's anything done to lessen the reliability of the service between cities, then that's going to reduce ridership.
But the railroad industry says these fears are overblown. In fact, the Association of American Railroads says giving Amtrak trains absolute preference over freight would lead to what it calls harmful and irrational results. The group says it would add to congestion in the system and create even greater delays for passenger and freight trains. The industry also maintains that Amtrak's on-time performance problems are caused more by Amtrak's unrealistic schedules than by railroads failing to give passenger trains preference. Ed Greenberg, a spokesperson for the Railroad Association, says the industry advocates a balanced approach.
This means trying to find that right transportation mix of serving the needs of passenger rail while ensuring the freight rail industry is continuing to meet the shipping requirements of their customers in moving the country's economy.
But Representative Peter DeFazio doesn't buy it. If the proposals are approved, he says,
I think you're going to be standing in the station watching a few more freight trains go by before your Amtrak arrives, and it's going to be even further behind schedule.
The Surface Transportation Board has closed comment on the two proposals. Officials have no estimate of when decisions might be reached. I'm Liam Moriarty reporting.
Sponsors of a measure that would allow judges to take guns away from people deemed a risk to themselves or others turned in more than 330,000 signatures last week before the deadline in Washington State. Initiative 1491 would create extreme risk protection orders, allowing family members to petition a court and ask a judge to temporarily suspend a person's access to firearms. Backers are now waiting for signature validation from the Secretary of State and will likely find out in the next few weeks if the measure qualifies for the ballot. Opponents argue the risk orders would not provide sufficient due process to gun owners. The measure is based on other risk orders already in place. In 2014, Washington State lawmakers passed a bill that allows judges to order domestic violence offenders deemed a threat to others to surrender their guns. The measure might also help prevent suicide, which account for nearly 80% of all firearm deaths in the state. Two other states, California and Connecticut, have recently passed similar risk order laws. The recent police shootings of African American men and the retaliation shootings against police officers themselves has reignited the debate over the use of deadly force. That was on the mind of a black community leader in Washington State last week. Karen Johnson strapped on a gun belt and took aim inside a state-of-the-art training simulator for police. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins was there and has this report.
We're at the Washington State Patrol Academy in Shelton. Corporal Lori Hines guides a pair of visitors into what looks like a walk-in video game.
It's a little dark. Watch your step.
Inside, five large video screens form a 300-degree computer-generated environment. The actors in the video scenarios are different races, but this program isn't designed to measure bias. Instead, it's meant to test an officer's de-escalation tactics and decisions about when to use deadly force. On this day, Karen Johnson, Ph.D., is about to experience the highly realistic simulator.
I'm not Dr. Johnson. I'm Trooper Johnson today. Okay.
Johnson is a founding member of the Black Alliance of Thurston County. It's a group that was created after a white Olympia police officer shot and wounded two African-American brothers. She's also a member of a newly formed legislative task force on police deadly force. Now Johnson is about to step into the shoes of a police officer. In this scenario, she responds to a noise complaint in a neighborhood. The lifelike scene shows a bearded man revving his motorcycle in his garage as an annoyed neighbor looks on. He then picks up a hammer, and things quickly get out of hand.
Are you doing anything wrong?
No problem. Just relax. Could you put your weapon down for a moment, please? We just want to have a chat. Nice bike, by the way. Is that a Harley?
Moments later, the man puts down the hammer and pulls out a sawed-off shotgun and starts blasting away. In the scenario, Officer Johnson has been shot dead. Even so, she gets some praise from Corporal Mitchell Bauer, one of the Academy trainers.
You did a really good job in this scene of acknowledging that he did have a weapon in his hand right away. You did try to initiate a conversation, and you tried to do a little de-escalation by commenting on his motorcycle, which is very, very good things that we're looking for.
In the next scenario, the officer must confront a despondent man in a pickup truck who's just been fired from his job. This time, within seconds of arriving on the scene, Johnson pulls her gun and shoots after a citizen suddenly warns her the man is armed. Johnson immediately realizes her mistake.
When he says, oh, he's got a gun, well, there still isn't a reason to shoot at that point because I haven't validated whether or not that's true.
It's split-second decisions like these that officers have to train for. And in this day and age, newly minted officers know they're going to be under the microscope, especially if they resort to deadly force. Bauer, the instructor, says it's a constant topic of conversation with new recruits.
They have been watching the news, they've been watching things unfold throughout America, and that is something that comes in every class. They ask those questions of how is this going to look if this happens.
Bauer says what he tries to impart on new troopers is that they must be willing to use deadly force if necessary, but whenever possible, their goal should be to de-escalate. New troopers are now also trained in crisis intervention, and starting this year, all current troopers will be trained in implicit or unconscious bias. For instance, how a white officer might view a black person differently. When it's my turn in the simulator, I confront a mentally ill homeless man who's trespassing on a vacant lot. As soon as I show up, he unleashes a profanity-laced tirade. He then reaches into his bag and pulls out a knife.
Sir, can you put down the knife, please?
Soon, he's slowly advancing toward me with the knife. I have him at gunpoint.
Please put down the knife, sir.
But I don't shoot. Afterwards, Corporal Bauer debriefs the scenario with me.
Could you have shot this person legally and been justified?
Probably so.
Probably so, right? But once again, and I mentioned this earlier, just because you're justified at doing something doesn't mean that you have to do that.
Washington State has perhaps the most protective law in the nation for police officers who use deadly force. To convict an officer of wrongfully killing someone requires a finding that the officer acted in bad faith and with malice. Karen Johnson would like to see that law changed, but she says that alone is not the answer.
We have to really have a collective approach to this.
Just hours before we went through the simulator, the news broke of the shooting of Alton Sterling by Baton Rouge, Louisiana police. As we sat in the car ready to leave the State Patrol Academy, Johnson said she was thinking about Sterling's family.
Here we go again. What is it going to take for us to stop the killings, stop the narrative, to be about public trust, public safety, public accountability? What is it going to take?
Johnson hopes the legislative task force she's on is able to come up with some answers. I'm Austin Jenkins reporting.
And a little closer to home, The Astoria Police Department is hosting Citizen Police Academy for 6 weeks, September 15th through October 20th, Thursday evenings from 6 to 9 p.m. Come learn how your police department works. You can learn the functions of patrol, basic defense tactics, and more. An application can be downloaded from the police department website. That's all we have time for on this edition of The Bridge. If you missed any part or just want to hear it again, it will be available as a podcast on our website at coastradio.org. I'm Kate Brister. Thank you for listening. Join us next time on The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.